infidelity. Still, he easily won the March primary, and in this heavily Democratic district, that primary win all but seals the deal for November. But he does have opponents, and the Republican candidate, Brian Woodworth, says Jackson's constituents need to know more about what's wrong.
People are going to be more understanding if the typical treatment for his ailment is going to be 2 months or 3 months. You got to give them that. You got to give the voters the ability to weigh that out for themselves.
That sort of call is not unexpected from a political opponent, but now some of Jackson's Democratic colleagues are speaking up. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin.
If there is some medical necessity for him not saying more at this moment, then I will defer to that. But he will have to soon make a report on what he's struggling with, the physical condition he's struggling with.
And Congressman Luis Gutierrez added his voice. He says Jackson has a responsibility to give more information.
No one here has any reason to believe anything other than he is ill. Nobody has any reason to believe that. Why don't we just know what it is? And then we can move forward and we can know what it exactly we should pray for his recovery.
Jackson has built a strong bench of support among top South Suburban officials who share his dream of an airport in Piatone. His fans include Rich Hofeld, Homewood Village president. Hofeld says he respects Jackson so darn much, but he says, quote, "We'd like some more information at this point." Hofeld declined to be interviewed on tape, as did South Chicago Heights Mayor David Owen. But Owen says, quote, "At some point, as a congressional official, something needs to be said." He hopes a disclosure happens within a couple weeks. This is not a universal view among Southland officials.
In time, we will know, we will understand, but I think it needs to be on the congressman's time.
Rick Reinbold is village president of Richton Park.
His staff continues to be responsive to the needs of the district. He has my full and unconditional support.
Both Reinbold and another Jackson supporter, State Senator Kwame Raoul of Chicago, bring up a federal law requiring health privacy. Just because Jackson is an elected official, Raoul says.
How much one decides to reveal, about a medical condition is personal.
Comparisons are being made to U.S. Senator Mark Kirk, who's been out of the public since suffering a stroke in January. Within a few days, Kirk's staff allowed reporters to question his surgeon at a press conference. It took more than 2 weeks for Jackson's staff to reveal his medical leave, and they've shared little information with the public about what the ailment or ailments are. Originally called exhaustion, the office last week said Jackson has grappled with certain physical and emotional ailments privately for a long period of time. Raoul says, with all kinds of illness, there are potential stigmas to consider.
If others are jumping to conclusions based on a diagnosis, it could be unfair. And that's why privacy is important.
And Raoul says 2nd District residents can always vote for another candidate if they're upset with Jackson's level of disclosure or with the votes he's missing in the House. In reality, roll call votes in Congress are rarely close. In the 70-plus votes Jackson has missed this past month and the more than 170 Senator Kirk has missed this year, in none of those instances would their votes have changed the outcome. I'm Sam Hudzik.
A Cook County policy of disregarding immigration detainers is catching on. Bills modeled after the policy are passing in other parts of the country, most recently the District of Columbia yesterday. Some Republicans in Congress want the trend stopped. Chip Mitchell reports.
The detainers are requests that a jail hold inmates up to 2 business days beyond what their criminal case requires. The requests help ICE, that's short for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, put the inmates into deportation proceedings. But Cook County officials say detainers also erode community trust in local police. Last September, the county enacted an ordinance that halted its compliance with them.
It's a model piece of legislation.
Ron Hampton is a retired cop in the nation's capital who pushed for the bill there.
The whole notion around the ICE detainer being a voluntary process, the Cook County legislation was very critical and a part of the development for the legislation in the District of Columbia.
New York City and Connecticut have curtailed compliance with immigration detainers. A county in California did, too. And this month, the California Senate approved a version for the whole state. The wave is putting pressure on the Obama administration. In a House committee hearing yesterday, Republicans pressed ICE Director John Morton. He said his agency has tried to work with Cook County.
I don't think that approach is going to work in full. We're going to need the help of others. We have been exploring our options under federal law. with the Department of Justice, and we will see.
Morton said he'd also push for a cutoff of some federal funds for the Cook County Jail. Those words won praise from the Republican who chairs the House panel. But as the Cook County model spreads, some immigration enforcement advocates are calling for a tougher federal response. I'm Chip Mitchell in Chicago.
This spring, Champaign County Sheriff Dan Walsh told federal officials his county also would not honor ICE requests to hold immigrants under the Secure Communities program. He said then that he would only turn inmates in the county jail over to ICE officials if they have a warrant or court order. Company Google is expected to pay a $22.5 million fine for breaching the privacy settings for millions of Apple users. It would be the largest ever to the Federal Trade Commission. The case targets Google's use of a computer code that tracks web searches from Apple's Safari, even when users had explicitly blocked the tracking from occurring. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
Jonathan Mayer, a computer science grad student at Stanford, discovered that Google was tracking millions of Apple computer users without their consent. The search giant was tricking Apple's Safari web browser into believing that these users were filling out web surveys that didn't actually exist. These fake interactions allowed Google to start placing cookies on the browsers and selling targeted ads.
This feature was not any sort of commonly accepted business practice. We only identified four companies that were doing it.
Mayer says Google was by far the biggest. He discovered this behavior just months after Google signed a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission, promising not to mislead Americans about its privacy policies. Now, according to sources familiar with the investigation, Google has agreed to pay a $22.5 million fine. Jeffrey Chester runs the Center for Digital Democracy, a privacy watchdog group.
The question is whether this fine will really change Google's practices when it comes to privacy.
Even though this will be the largest civil penalty ever levied by the FTC, Google earns roughly that much money every 4.5 hours. And the deal doesn't require Google to admit violating its consent decree or breaking any federal laws. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Come along on our custom-designed trip to England and Wales this September. Experience the real Downton Abbey in a private tour just for friends of WILL. See lovely Cotswold villages, the Yorkshire countryside, and meet Alan J. W. Bell, producer of Last of the Summer Wine. Tour Greenway, Agatha Christie's home, the English spa town of Bath, and visit the Jane Austen Centre before wrapping up the trip in London. Our tour is almost full, so call 217-333-7300 for more information.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of the artist best known for a painting of his mother, James Abbott McNeil Whistler, born in Lowell, Massachusetts, 1834, who once said, "I do not choose to be born in Lowell." And indeed, when he was 21 years old, he left for Paris and never returned to the United States. He had gone to West Point, where he was something of a rebel. He wore his hair longer than was allowed, and the superintendent, Robert E. Lee, at the time, eventually kicked him out. James Whistler, who believed in art for art's sake, unlike most Victorians, did not believe that art or artists had a responsibility to convey a moral message. And the painting known as Whistler's Mother, entitled Arrangement in Gray and Black Number 1, is a painting of his mother, because Whistler's model, who was scheduled to come, did not show up. It's the birthday of E.B. White, Elwin Brooks White, born in Mount Vernon, New York, 1899, a writer for the New Yorker magazine for nearly 60 years. In 1938, he and his wife, Catherine Angel, left New York City, moved to a farm on the coast of Maine, where he wrote essays. His columns for Harper's collected in the book One Man's Meat. He wrote his famous essay Death of a Pig, in which he wrote, "I discovered that once having given a pig an enema, there is no turning back, no chance of resuming one of life's more stereotyped roles. The pig's lot and mine were inextricably bound, as though the rubber tube were the silver cord." And a few years after that, he wrote his famous book, Charlotte's Web, about a pig who is saved by a little girl and a clever spider. In the summer of 1948, E.B. White, sitting in a hotel room at the Algonquin during a heat wave in the city, wrote his essay, Here is New York, in which he wrote, "On any person who desires such queer prizes, New York will bestow the gift of loneliness and the gift of privacy. No one should come to New York to live unless he is willing to be lucky." And it's the birthday of Jhumpa Lahiri, born in London, 1967, settled in America in Rhode Island, where her father was a librarian. On weekends, the family would get together with other Bengali families to cook Bengali food and speak Bengali and reminisce. And her first book, The Interpreter of Maladies, was a collection of 9 stories about Bengalis living in suburban New England. The book came out as a trade paperback in 1999 and won the Pulitzer Prize. Here's a poem for today by Katrina Vandenberg, Handwriting Analysis. On the first day of fourth grade, Mrs. Hunter collected our penmanship samples to save until June. By then, she said, we'd write in the handwriting we would have all our lives. Though she probably read that in a book on child development, I was so excited I could hardly stand it. In 9 months, my adult self would be born. She would send me a letter. In the ways she swooped, careened, and crossed her T's, I could read everything I would need to know. We were writing ourselves into the future. We came closer each time we turned the silver gears in the sharpener near the door, the wood shavings tumbling inside, smelling as if a house were being built. A poem by Katrina Vandenberg, Handwriting Analysis, from The Alphabet Not Unlike the World, published by Milkweed Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.